Read a hymn before you read the word and see what difference it'll make. This is a neglected book. I know the Christians that I meet with. They neglect it. Why do they neglect it? They don't understand it. Well, you're not alone in thinking that. John Calvin never wrote a commentary on this book. And he was asked why. You know what he said? I don't understand it. We can take some comfort in that, can't we? If you say I don't understand it, we've some work to do. We don't ignore it. There's a blessing in the reading then, public reading of it. I don't understand that. But that's what it says to us. And a key, there's many keys to open this book. And one of the keys I learned a long time ago was this is not a history book. This is a picture book. And if you can see that in pictures, you'll get a better grip of it. I think children understand this better than we do because they've got great imaginations. And if you're talking about ten-horned beasts, they'll draw you a lovely ten-horned beast with great imagination. What does the ten-horned beast represent? Well, that is the issue. But there are many beasts in here, aren't there? There's 144,000 people. The Jehovah's Witnesses will confuse you with that. There's the thousand-year reign of Christ. The millennium, the signs and symbols. But I believe everything in it conveys one message. It's the multicolored facet of the power and the wisdom and the love of God. Multicolored. I can't think of any other word. Technicolor. That's what we have here. And basically what it says is God reigns. It doesn't matter who sits in Washington as president of the USA. What is any man or woman that takes that office in comparison to God? And that's not to belittle these people that take on these tasks. The Korean, the Chinese, all these leaders, what are they? They are all subject to God. And God has his way. He brings them onto the stage of history for purpose. For purpose. And sometimes it causes a lot of doubt. What is the purpose? But you can be sure of one thing. God knows what the purpose is. God knows why he raises them up. Have you ever wondered when Jeremiah talked about the 70-year bondage in Babylon, that one would come and he named the man, Cyrus. It confuses the liberals, doesn't it? How can a man see so far into the future? Well, he didn't. God showed him the future. And he named him Cyrus. God's man was Cyrus. Who would have ever expected that? And who knows what will happen? But I know God is on the throne. God is on the throne. And Satan can never thwart God's plans. Never. Who is greater than God? He's the creator. And they're restrained, a lot of them. Now this book divides into two parts. Chapters 1 and 3. Very simple. And they form the first part. If you just go back to chapter 1, verse 19, key word here. Write these things, John is told, which you have seen and things which are. Those things that which are is what he's just telling you in chapters 1, 2 and 3. And the things that will take place after this moment in time. Not at the end of time, not a long time in the future, after this time. And what that tells me is that this book is not written 2,000 years ago, just less than that, for people who will have no interest in it, that it will have no meaning for them. Any of you write a letter to a dead family member? We don't do that. Does God send an epistle, his last epistle, to say, this isn't for you? This is for a generation that comes after ours, or later still than that. And a lot of people come to that conclusion that it isn't for us because of what we read in chapter 4 and verse 1. After these things I looked, and behold, a door standing open in heaven. And the first voice which I heard was like a trumpet speaking with me, saying, come up here. Who's coming up here? Who is God calling, come up here? And to me, you've got to take it quite simply. John is invited. But he's not literally going into heaven because he's in the Spirit. His feet remain firm and fixed, I believe, on Patmos. He's totally in this, I don't like to use the word ecstatic, but it's a spiritual heightened experience where the surroundings he no longer is aware of. My wife says that sometimes to me when I'm in a study. He's not aware of the catastrophe that's going down in the kitchen. I can cry help and he's lost in his books. John is called up there. Not the church. Some people see the church raptured. I don't see that. Why not? Well, what is the use of the difficulties that are going to come from chapter 4:2 to the end of the book? And there are big difficulties coming. There are awesome things going to happen. Have happened, will happen, and will continue to happen to the end of time. You wouldn't have liked to have been alive, I suspect, in Queen Mary's reign. Alan and I would probably have been burnt at the stake for holding fast to the Reformed truth. Perhaps others with us. She killed a lot of godly men. God permitted that for purpose. You may not understand that. You may not ever know until, I think one day when we arrive there, we will understand. We will say, he did it his way because there was no other way. And that jigsaw piece is yet to be put into place for us to see and understand. So I think that John there is elevated in a spiritual experience, and he sees things that are for the good of the church in every age. They need comfort when it's difficult. They need encouragement when it's darkness. And it's one thing for the pastor to encourage you time and time again, but when God encourages you through the word to say, hold on, I'm in charge, I'm on the throne, nothing will thwart the purposes of God, surely there is comfort and hope for those of us that have got our problems and our difficulties. Paul says the same thing, does he not, in Romans? Romans 8:28, learned that as a youngster. Even if I was a Christian, I could repeat that to you. All things, hear that? All things, not some things, not the good things. All things work together for good for those that love God. Thank you. Love God. Called according to his purpose. Are you called of God? Have you been called out of darkness? Have you been called into his light? All things will work together for good for you for the rest of your days. That is not promising you a bed of roses. Anybody had a life of a bed of roses as a Christian? I've never met one. It almost seems as if you're going to start getting blessed, you get excited about something in the word that you read, something that really elevates your soul to God, and you're really, you know, this is imagination of mine. There's an alarm bell, you know, like Batman's cape. Alarm bell in hell. Go and play havoc with Brian. He's getting alive to God. And God may allow that. And God may not. I want to touch Job. Well, yes, but you can't kill him. We've got to look at those things, haven't we, and see his sovereign control. You see, Satan is bound. Have you read Pilgrim's Progress? Pilgrim, going down the narrow way, he sees two lions, a roaring lion. You know what Peter speaks about, the roaring lion? Wanting to devour us. A picture of the enemy trying to devour us. frightened to go down that road until what? Until he sees these lions are chained and held in God's hands. And he walks straight along the path. That's a picture. What a mind. What a book. Misunderstood. It's almost as misunderstood as Revelation. I'd love to preach through that sometime. It would be wonderful to look at those pictures and what they tell us. I could say some more on that, but I won't. I will leave that there. So this is a book that's for us today. It's the letter for us today and for tomorrow and for the rest of our lives and for those that have yet to come. What encouragement. God's last word to his people is a word of encouragement, and everything is in good hands. You remember that John was on Patmos penal colony? I wonder what he was doing. We don't know. I like to challenge congregations to put themselves in the picture. If you were on Patmos in a penal colony, what would you have been doing? Sunshine and another lovely day? You're not just sunbathing all day, are you? Do you think he had an Old Testament with him? When you read this book, you see everything steeped in the Old Testament. Everything. It may not be true. He'll have read that Old Testament very well over the years. His Bible would have been worn out. And God was showing him things there. Now John looked and saw this door open in heaven. What does he see? This vision. It's similar to it. You need to read this for yourselves in Ezekiel 1. I'll quote to you from Ezekiel 1 and verse 1. As I was among the captives by the river Shebar, the heavens were open and I saw visions of God. And he sees creatures very similar to what we've read about here. Very similar. And he gives us some clues if we take the time to ponder that. And he was in the spirit and he comes up and sees into heaven. John alone has that experience. What does he see? First thing, the most dazzling thing, the most wonderful thing, the throne of God. I suspect we've all been thinking about what thrones represent over these past few days, 10 days or so. People that sit on the throne of the nation, of our land, and things that are being spoiled or made difficult in so many ways. That's human thrones. I've never seen the Game of Thrones film. I've no desire for what folks have told me. But I would say to people who tell me that, I know a better throne. I love them to tell me, have you seen the Game of Thrones? No, I've seen a much better one. Oh, tell me, what's the video called? I said, Revelation chapter 4. And you get into conversation, what's that all about? I said, go and read it for yourself and come and chat with me. And some do, and some think, oh, he's a crank, he's a nutter. Anyway, Game of Thrones. And he sees this throne, and the starting point is the throne of God. Where else should it begin? When the rest of the book is going to be talking about conflict and difficulty and warfare and the powers of darkness raging against God and his people. And this symbol of the throne is saying loud and clear, this is the throne of Almighty God. All-pervading authority sits on this throne. The purpose and the will of the ones that sit on this throne, they will see through their plans, their desires, their things that they decree. This isn't a Brexit thing that's going to get put on one side. This is God made in decrees in eternity past that have been woven into our tapestry, and they will unravel themselves. And the thing to take home from tonight, if you get anything else, God's on the throne, God is ruling. This is a ruled universe, and it's ruled by one that's our friend. And he will rule it for the good of his people and for his glory. Those two things wonderfully are intertwined, and it's therefore a great encouragement. And I think today when I talk to Christian people, and I see how weak their doctrine is. That's what's wrong with, well, one of the many things that's wrong with our church today is they don't understand the purposes of God, but it makes it clear in his word. There's a weakness in their doctrine of God. And one of the weaknesses is this. Is God sovereign? Many Christians say to me, I can thwart God. I can stop God. That makes man sovereign. And then other Christians say, oh, hang on a minute, what about Satan? He's surely got a... Is Satan sovereign? There's none. None of those. God is sovereign. God is in charge of what he has created. And if you read this fourth chapter, is it 10 or 11 times in these 11 verses? 10 times, guess which word keeps cropping up? Thrones. There's a throne. He's shouting it out. A government in complete control of everything. And in the face of your problems, you have your problems, I have my problems, look up and see the throne. A friend of mine used to preach on Morecambe Promenade, and he went past the bingo hall one day and he heard them say, eyes down, look in. He said, that's just what the opposite of a Christian ought to do. Look up and see Jesus. And I thought, I've never forgotten what he said there. Our eyes, if they're looking down, they're looking in the wrong place. If our eyes are looking in, what can we do against tyrannies? Look up and see your salvation. Look unto Jesus, the author and the finisher of your faith. He is leading everything to final victory. That's a glorious thought, isn't it? The divine program is ticking along very nicely. Nothing takes God by surprise. Your stubborn resistance, my stubborn resistance, is overcome by the power of God. He will take me where he wants to take me. Jonah tried to run away from Tarshish. Where did he end up? Gone round in circles till he went back to Tarshish. You can't run away from God. You can try. The psalmist tried. Couldn't do it. You can't run away from God. What else does John see here? And this is one of the glorious things about this passage. He says things that must. Little word, four-letter word, that's the biggest word in here, must take place. Do you see it there in verse 1? The voice of God saying, these things must take place. God foreknows, therefore he predestinates. That's Romans 8, 29 and 30. How else does God know the future if he hasn't planned it? He's got it all under his absolute control. And that's where we rest, in his control. Foreknows is the key word. Some people who don't like that doctrine, don't like that teaching, say, well, God knew that I would become a Christian. He foreknew that. That's not what that word is saying. God is saying in eternity past, before Brian ever existed. Yes, he could see what was going to happen, but he decreed that it would happen. He decreed the family I was put into. A family that sent me to church, though they never went themselves. Under influences that weren't good. But then bringing people to work that told me of Christ. He decreed these people to come into these places. You see that as you look back. The tapestry that God has woven in your life. Bringing people in that change your lives. We were talking this afternoon amongst ourselves. And Alan was reminding us. One of the many funerals he's been taken, and there was something that he never said changed the life of one of the listeners. That's amazing what God does with a silence. You'll have to ask Alan if you want to know what that story is all about. Foreknowledge. God does what he wants to do. Things are about to be shown John throughout this book that are going to be God working out what's planned, what's determined, what will happen. And the final happiness and the redemption of his people will be the outcome. Wonderful. We shouldn't be afraid of coming events. We shouldn't be afraid if we're persuaded God has got it all under control. It's in good hands. When we were planning birthdays at home, we were always asking, what's going to happen on my birthday? And Dad would say to us, Mum's got it all under control. We knew it would be a great occasion because she was in control in that kitchen and whatever she was providing and preparing. God's always in control because he's ordained what takes place. And that means we can quietly, not stoically, not like the Muslims, que sera, sera. We believe in taking action, in moving, in finding and moving with the things of God. It causes us to be humble because we're led by such a mighty hand and we're directed in paths that he would want us to be in. There's no better way. There's no other way than follow Jesus. Do you remember Jesus as a 12-year-old boy? If you want to look it up sometime, it's in Luke chapter 2. And do you remember they'd gone there for the feast of the Passover? And then they started to go home and there was a great group of them going back. And 12-year-old Jesus wasn't with Mary and Joseph. And they thought, where was he? Well, somebody else in the group's got him. He's one of the other families. He's with the Bruntons. He's with what have you. They look after them. And after 3 days, panic. He's not there. You know the story? They go back to Jerusalem. Where did they find him? He's discussing with the great scholars of the day about the things of God, and they're amazed with what he's saying. And I'll quote to you. I can't quote to you what I was going to say. Ah, yes. Why have you done this to us? His parents say. And he says this. Did you not know that I must be about my father's business? 12-year-old, first time that we've got recorded in scriptures his first words. Who told this 12-year-old boy that Joseph wasn't his father, but that he stood in relation to the eternal God as the unique Son of God? That's him as a 12-year-old. Wow. I must be about my father's business. And it says somewhere in that passage, I think, Mary pondered these things in her heart. We need to ponder them. But 21 years later, he's back in Jerusalem. Almost to the same place. And he allows himself to be taken captive and carried away to judgment and to crucifixion. And he warns his disciples when they first come upon him. Peter takes his sword, remember, wants to use it and cut off the ear of one of the people. And he tells them, don't do it. I could call on my father and he would send 12 legions of angels to come to my rescue. But that's not the plan. That's not the plan. The full power of heaven was at his disposal. And Matthew 26, 53 and 54 says this. How then could the scriptures be fulfilled that it must happen thus? You see, that word must keeps cropping up. Peter on the day of Pentecost, same sort of thing. Chapter 2, 23, him being delivered by the carefully planned intention and foreknowledge of God. You have taken by lawless hands, have crucified and put to death. I still prefer the determinate counsel and knowledge of God, but there we are. Peter is telling him God sent his son to the cross. God's saying, yes, you took him. You did this. This was wrong, but this was the plan. It was the plan from eternity. The Lamb slain before the foundation of the world. That's That's a remarkable statement when you really think about it. In the history of God's people, it's always about the things that befall them, the things which must be. Some save their lives by the skin of the neck, or was it by? God wanted still more from them. I think it was one of the Covenanters escaped from jail in Scotland, escaping from the troops that were looking to recapture him and put him to death. And he didn't know what to do, so he knocked on this door, and he didn't know what this door was. One of God's people. And he opened the door, and it saved his life. Could have knocked on the wrong door. Not when God's in control. You always knock on the right door when God's in control. And every event, however mysterious, however seemingly cruel, however much we think is inspired by Satan. And God does let the leash loose. I didn't say let go. It gives it a bit of room. You know, you take your dog a walk, I see these elongated leads now, and they go long way down the road. Where's the dog? He lets Satan loose. But he's reined in at times. Christian believers have got to make a choice between a sovereign God that knows what he's doing, knows what he's ordained, know where he's taking the plans and actions and all of this, especially with regards to redemption. You think about it in terms of redemption, and it will prove the point completely. Is God in control of saving sinners, or is the atoning sacrifice of his unique son left to be worked out by his people on earth? The initiative, the resolves that we take. Is that what it really comes down to? That's not my God. My God says, I will save who I will save. I will build my church. How do I know that? Great passage in Isaiah 53, the suffering servant. And he says this in verse 11. He, that is the Messiah, he shall see the travail of his soul and be satisfied. Satisfied with what? Satisfied with those that are being brought. Irresistibly drawn by the word of God. Brought into his plan, brought into his company, brought into the sheepfold, under the guidance of the good shepherd who laid down his life for the sheep. None of them shall be lost, says John. None of them. And the Father has given to the Son a people that will be his. It's wonderful, isn't it? It's wonderful. And people make all sorts of strange views when we talk about sovereignty and the decrees and purposes of God. These things must take place. And then we see the occupant of the throne. Who does he see? He doesn't see a body, does he? It's hard to describe what he sees. He's just describing colours and qualities and things about the incomparableness of God. God is a pure being. He's without body parts. So how could he describe body parts? You see, when you're looking into heaven, we have to think of heaven as something like this room in one sense, but a bit more purer. That might help you in your own little way, but that's not what the Bible is trying to teach us. And the occupant of the throne, well, he is all glorious. And it's hard to see what's being said here, especially when you look at the divine colours that are mentioned here in verse 3. You can read whatever commentary you want and whatever persuasion you're on. Nobody knows what these colours really are all about. I'm pleased about that. I've never seen a green rainbow, have you? I've seen a red, yellow, all those seven colours. I see green in the middle, but this is a green one. Rainbow, what does it shout out? Covenant with Noah. No more universal floods. Has there been a universal flood since? Well, they might think so in our country, but it's not been quite universal, has it? It's covered a few bits of our land. Torture for them, but keeps his promise. No more. And that's what we're seeing here. And it's a difficult to interpret it, and I don't wish to try to. Some people talk about the fiery red of judgment, and some people speak of the white, of the purity of God. Yeah, I believe that could be true. But the best description is what we sang. And we repeated that line there. Did I write it down? From the second hymn, the third hymn. I quoted it, didn't I? In light, inaccessible, hid from our eyes. That's the best description I've ever read of God. You might find one better. Then what else does he see? Well, he sees in verse 4 something that he sees you and me sitting on a throne. That's going to surprise you, isn't it? But that's what it actually means. Because 12 is the number of the church. Jacob had how many sons? 12. How many apostles of the church are there? 12. Go to chapter 21, in fact. He sees the new Jerusalem. And what does he see in verse 12? The names of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel written on the great high walls and the gates. And then in verse 14, the wall of the city had 12 foundations, and on them were the names of the 12 apostles. Now this is a very, very interesting position to take here. 12 times 12, 144,000. You see that picture again later in the book. It's the church. The church of the old and the church of the new. There is not a different church in the Old Testament to the church in the New Testament. They are synonymous. They are of the same ilk. They are all brought together through grace. And when we want to be tempted to ignore what the Old Testament has to say, we're ignoring a great potential to understand something of the church is there in the Old Testament that we have to grab hold of. It's there in shadows, but it will come out in full bloom later on. It's one church with two groupings. And a lot of Christians don't get that. A lot of Christians are waiting for a future day when we'll start again with Israel and start to do various things like sacrificial system being reintroduced. Why? Why? The high priest, the one great, only high priest that now ever lives to make intercession and has given the perfect sacrifice. He didn't have to offer a sacrifice for his own sins. He was sinless. All the priests and high priests of the Old Testament had to do that because they were sinful. Jesus didn't. But the Jews never saw him as Messiah. Why? He wasn't of the tribe of Levi. But he was of the kind of Melchizedek. And there's the mystery of Melchizedek, and we could spend a lot of time in that. But we won't. But he is the great high priest. There's no need to restore anything like that ever again. It's all complete in Christ. It's wonderful. It's glorious. And he sees a picture of you, if you're a believer, sat in the, whatever it's going to look like, around the throne. We're going to be there around the throne with multitudes of us. But you know, when I think of that, the multitudes that you hear are being converted, and down through the ages, what number should we say we're going to make it into heaven? Jesus still says, I will see him face to face. Isn't that wonderful? Whatever number you want to give him, billions. It's time for me. It's time for you. Isn't that wonderful? Are you waiting for that day? Are you looking forward to that day? He knows all about you. I'm looking forward to it. I hope you are. Well, what else? We see in verses 10 and 11, elders worshipping. Notice what it says in verse 10 and 11. I missed out the creatures because I don't want to spend too much time on that. Ezekiel tells us the cherubim or seraphim. That's all it is. Higher ranks of them that are just worshipping God. And they're worshipping God. And what happens in verse 10? Because they're worshipping God, we who are sat there in that same circumference, if we want to talk like that, we join in the worship and we throw our crowns. We at him, to him. They're nothing. They're nothing in comparison with the joy that we have of worshipping him who has saved us and loved us and kept us and brought us safe to him. And then he sees in verse 5, go back to that, the seven spirits. People have made a lot of that as well. It's just the different work of the Holy Spirit, the different elements of his ministry, and always ready to be at the will and the purposes of God. And that's how I see it. If you look at Zechariah 4, look at Zechariah 4 today. Have a read of that. Look at the lampstand and how it's perennially kept. Oh, where's the oil coming from? The supply is from God. It's God. And then these creatures. Well, I've said something about them. They're very similar to what Ezekiel saw. And the cherubim. Do you know what one of the cherubim's positions was when Adam and Eve sinned? They were thrown out of the garden. It would have been catastrophic for them to stay in that sinless position in that garden. You need to think about that carefully. I haven't got time to develop that. The cherubim guard the garden. They're not coming back in that state. They're lost. They're unregenerate. They need changing. And that comes in the story. They can't go back to that tree of life. Only the redeemed can have access to the tree of life. And you see them, don't you, in the Holy of Holies, on the mercy seat, the cherubim, and all that. They're just pictures. And you can say what you want. A lion, its strength, and man is intelligent. I wonder that day, sometimes when I see man today. And we can go on. And verse 11 talks about many angels around the throne, all overwhelmed with God. The redeemed of God sit there and worship, all created by him. The key is the sovereignty of God. He's working it all out. He's working it all out for you, and he's working it all out for me. Behind everything is the will of God. Behind everything is the decree of God. Behind everything is his loving, working out the purposes of God. And that belief in that one that sits upon the throne, that lives like that, that does stand strong and secure. That gives us hope, that gives us comfort, that gives us boldness, that gives us all sorts of things. And it says in the scriptures, we can come with confidence before the throne of grace. Boldly. We were barred from it in our lost estate. Now he says, come to the throne of grace. I wonder if you find that enticing, to be able to go to the throne of grace and to pour out your heart, pour out your soul, pour out the longings of your heart. He longs to hear that. When you read the Song of Solomon, of a love story between the king and his lover, and it's a picture of Christ's love for the church. It says from the king, I love to hear her voice. Did you know that he loves to hear your voice? Your voice. And you believe that? I do. I let him hear go there. It's a safe place. Just before we sing this hymn, I wanted to quote from it. I love this hymn, The Sands of Time Are Sinking. You can be looking it up, 816. And I like this, the last verse. I've wrestled on towards heaven. You have a sense of that, you know? The struggles of church, the problems of church, the difficulties of people in and out of the church and all of this. Gainst storm and wind and tide. Now like a weary traveller that leans upon his guide, amid the shades of evening, while sinks life's lingering sun, I'll hail the glory dawning from Emmanuel's land. That's where the throne is, in Emmanuel's land. Are you destined to see that throne yourself? Let's stand and sing this closing hymn, 816, The Sands.